What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Alo or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to the Occult Disney Podcast, where we open up the hood of the Mickey Mouse's Mirthmobile and see what's under, what secrets lie inside. Sorry, I just winged that intro. I don't know. I was experimenting. I was trying something new. This is Matt here. With me today is Thomas Gorenz, the Paranoid American. Howdy.
Hey, that's me. And I like that intro, though. We could work on some cool ones, like... Tonight we're gonna sacrifice the sacred mouse under the full moon or something.
Oh yeah, rock on. Okay, I can do that. But today we're definitely from the occult perspective. We got a lot to chew on. It's a Sleeping Beauty, which lots of, you know, last one was like Lady and the Tramp. We had a little bit of trouble putting the lens on that one because, well, it's basically a talking animal movie, so.
It's going to, ironically, it's going to come in helpful today, though, because there's going to be a couple nods back to Lady and the Tramp specifically, which will be all worth it.
Yeah, because the production of these movies were like all intertwined.
Right.
It seems Sleeping Beauty, it's either Sleeping Beauty or Black Cauldron that hold the record for longest Disney production. I think they're about the same in the end. So because Sleeping Beauty got, I mean, production was rolling in like 52, 53, somewhere along there.
Yeah, the script production started in 51, so it was a long process for sure.
Yeah, we can kind of from there. And then there's like a series of directors, which I found weird, because the first guy had a heart attack, and then they'd bring in a director, and he'd do like a few sequences, like one of the Nine Old Men did the just the forest sequences. He was the director of that, and then production just kind of slowed down for a few years, and when they got going again, he wasn't directing anymore. So we basically have like five directors on this movie, which is kind of weird. I guess I don't understand enough about how animation works, but
I mean, maybe you just grinded them all the way down to the bone.
Yeah, and this seems to be one where Walt Disney himself was equally interested and uninterested in this movie. Like, it seems he really knew he had to put it like a corker of an animation, you know, a spectacle. But at the same time, you know, Disneyland and the TV show seem to have been like his main focuses at the same time, where you get the weird synergy of you know, Sleeping Beauty's castle showing up at Disneyland 3.5 years before the movie was even released.
It's also just overwhelming to think about all the projects that Walt had going on as this one guy. And you know, of course he had the beginnings of this global conglomerate starting to form around him, but he still was like a mortal person here on the planet Earth that was overseeing, you know, like we could say arguably the best Walt Disney animation that they ever kind of produced was sort of Sleeping Beauty. There's a strong argument that I can make here, but he's also got all these theme parks going on and all of the other, you know, business related stuff that's going on that he has his hands in because he's a control freak. So, I mean, sometimes I get overwhelmed when, you know, I've got like an appointment and like one other thing to do in addition to my normal job. But this guy, you know, he was just nonstop working on crazy things.
No, I mean, if I had been in that time and place, my focus would have been on Disneyland. I mean, I obsess over the theme parks now, so it makes sense. But yeah, I guess we'll just start a little bit with animation style. This is the second kind of widescreen Disney movie. When we were doing Lady and the Tramp, I think we were like, it's nice, but it didn't really need to be. Where Sleeping Beauty definitely needs to be. I feel like, yeah, the overall package is probably Disney's best, but we are missing the almost inhumanly possible to do in the first place details that you see in, say, Fantasia or Snow White. So there's a little bit of artistry lacking, I guess, in that, just that kind of for beginner's luck, I guess.
I don't know. I think we can debate on this one a little bit, because I find Sleeping Beauty to be intensely detailed, maybe even beyond some of the aspects of Snow White. I think Snow White had very detailed matte paintings and background paintings, although the animations itself, specifically the rotoscoping and the characters, they were a little bit flat. For their time, it was groundbreaking, you know, but if you compare them frame by frame, maybe some of the background paintings are, you know, detailed in different ways, but the animation itself and the rotoscoping and the capturing of all the different sort of flow and perspectives, I think it's far superior in Sleeping Beauty. Like, it's not even a close comparison.
Well, that's what I'm saying. As a package, I think Sleeping Beauty probably is the height of Disney animation. But just if you want to take specific animation, I always think of the water in Fantasia as being like basically number one, because that's just insane. Although sometimes there's animation we don't even know about. I just read a production book, Space Odyssey, about the making in 2001, not realizing that they had a bunch of basically interns like having to animate the stars in that movie. So they spent months just like making little splotches, you know,
and
like
they probably didn't even get their name anywhere near the credits either.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, even come on, that movie, even the people who really did the effects ended up with the final credit of, you know, special effects directed and conceived by Stanley Kubrick, you know. So that was a little bit of a raw one he pulled there, I guess. But
and this one's a little bit interesting too, talking about the animation style and just the aesthetics in general, is that there was, I think it was like a behind the scenes or like one of those DVD commentaries, but I was watching it and they mentioned that Walt was very disappointed in a few of his previous productions, specifically Alice in Wonderland, I think, that the original concept art that was done by Mary Blair was so very like striking and it had such a distinct style to it. But by the time it got all the way through the art directors and all the way through the animators and then, you know, ended up on the final film reel, it didn't really capture that same sort of like artistic flair that I guess Mary Blair had originally captured. And that happened, I think, two or three times. And Walt didn't want that to happen on this particular film. And so he gave almost exclusive creative control over to Evan Earle, I believe. And once this guy takes over, anytime there was like a dispute on like, hey, I don't think it should look like this, Walt would just immediately side with this one guy every time, because he was so myopic and so laser focused on making sure that original concept art made its way all the way through to the final product and it didn't kind of get lost in all the adaptation of the process. And he actually did a really good job of it. And there was this whole interview about where they found these things called the Hunt of the Unicorn or the Unicorn Tapestries, which were these old tapestries from the actual 1500s, I believe. And they essentially remade that same aesthetic, but animated it and turned it into cartoons. And if you look at some of the frames in Sleeping Beauty side by side by some of those unicorn tapestries, like you can, it's undeniable in the likenesses that they were able to capture and then kind of bring it to life. So it's just noteworthy in that this is one of the very rare and probably the only last, you know, time that Walt gave this full creative control over to someone and sided with him on almost every dispute that had kind of come up. So that one was interesting to me. And it also explains why this one does have a decent, consistent style, despite going through five different directors.
Yeah. Although apparently it really did piss off the animators because they...
Oh, yeah.
the what we see on screen, of course, is great. So I guess in this case, Walt was right, or Earl was right. But Mm-hmm. Yeah, they basically felt like kind of robbed of their own creativity making it. Well, we have the I can't say this guy's name, Juron Omini. Anyway, the quote is that Earl's paintings lack the mood in a lot of things. All that beautiful detail in the trees, the bark and all that, that's all well and good, but who the hell is going to look at that? The backgrounds became more important than the animation. He'd made them more like Christmas cards. So Christmas cards can be nice.
Well, and Christmas cards were actually some of the original inspirations for that concept work that I mentioned that Mary Blair had worked on. Like, Walt loved that style. And this one in particular, Sleeping Beauty, they did capture that. And like you said, I think the proof is in the pudding a little bit. So the animators, I believe, won a couple small little scuffles. Like, there was originally the three fates, like the three fairies were all going to look almost identical and just kind of have different like colored dresses. And the animators were able to push back on that a little bit. And then they added a little bit more characters. There was like the drinking bard at one of the scenes when the two kings are discussing the wife, or, you know, the princess and the prince and how they're going to get together. And as they're doing this, the bard like keeps drinking more and more wine and gets really drunk. That one was like in particular something that the animators were able to just do because they kind of owned that particular character. And that was the sort of silly cartooniness that they were trying to inject this entire time, which was sort of juxtaposing and clashing with Earl's, you know, sort of more serious vision. But I think that they were paired up so perfectly, like, because you've got a little bit of that goofy cartooniness, but then you also have like a very serious medieval looking aesthetic that kind of gets carried through the entire movie.
Yeah. Earl left Disney shortly before they finished this. So he wasn't there for like the final. So I guess the animators got in a bit of the last laugh, as it said, they had Earl's background paintings like softened and diluted a little bit from the what it says is distinct medieval texture, which I'm not, I guess that's more like the tapestry look. So I don't know. I guess that's a good compromise, though, because again, nothing's wrong with looking at this movie. So
there's a couple other cool notes, too, that a guy, Mark Davis, did some of the character design, and he created the characters. I mean, no one person designs the characters, but he's credited with doing a lot of the initial concept development and just developing the silhouettes and the process you go through on making like balanced characters. And he made it with the princess and with Maleficent, you know, Aurora and Maleficent, and was able to capture that like interesting dynamic between the two. And then he went on and made the 101 Dalmatians, and he did Cruella de Vil. So that was kind of noteworthy to me, because the same guy that designed both those characters, and both of those characters are the main ones that are kind of getting this like revamp where they were the good guys all along, you know, like the modern movies. And that's been Maleficent and Cruella de Vil.
I guess it's partly because this movie had such a long production that this sort of thing's bound to happen. But the people that worked on it are kind of interesting too. Apparently, while Warner had shut down their animation for a few years, Chuck Jones actually did work on this movie, which is pretty wild to think about. And since Don Bluth was basically an intern, maybe animating stars for this movie, so nothing particularly creative, but he was there. So it's just interesting to have all those people working on the same movie.
Honestly, I don't know if he had anything to do with the scene. I think it was Mark Davis that also worked on that final scene between the prince and Maleficent as the dragon, but I swear that dragon had some Don Bluth DNA somewhere in it.
Maybe he was shouting from the back of the room or something. they just, you know, got stuck in their subconscious or whatever.
And another cool note about that really insane sort of fight sequence that comes at the end of the movie is that it was essentially designed by Mark Davis, and he was a fighter pilot in World War II, and he likened like the action sequences to sort of him being in like a dogfight where things just like happen so fast that you can't even think about it, where like the prince is, you know, getting attacked and it looks like he's about to die and it happens so quickly. But the way that he described that was based on his experience as a fighter pilot in the World War.
Did you ever make it to Tokyo Disney?
No, I did not.
Okay. They have in their castle, they have an actual attraction, which was facing the dragon, and they get a kid from the audience to, you know, like It might have been somewhere. No, I think it was based on Sleeping Beauty, but where they have to battle the dragon. It was truly like the most traumatizing Disney attraction ever, because it was like you're in this dank basement. There's like loud, sharp noises coming around. There's a scary dragon animatronic, and your kids were screaming. Even as an adult doing it, I was like, "Yeah, this is pretty creepy."
The Florida version had the alien encounter, I believe, which was an amazing ride, but that was also deemed just beyond scary, way more scary than the demographic was for the park. But man, I don't know if have you ever heard of it or seen any videos on it, the alien encounter.
I've heard of it. I think by the time I got to it, it's when they had like rethemed a Stitch to kids wouldn't poop themselves in the theater.
It was very similar, but it had like these little speakers, and it would seem like they were right behind you, and you could feel it like breathing down your neck. And it had a lot of like jump scare and like flashing light kind of moments that people complained about. So yeah, Lilo and Stitch it was. But it was an amazing experience that didn't feel at all that's something you'd find at Disney World.
The one that got me the most, I think it was Honey, I Shrunk the Audience, is where they, the seat kind of pokes you in the back. It's like supposed to be a bee sting or something. And then like every other time I went to that attraction, I'd just be like sitting up because I did not like getting punched randomly punched in the back. So I was at the edge of my seat because I didn't want to get punched in the back. So. we should really, I guess, start looking a little more closely at this one. I mean, the movie is just as far as content and everything, because there's a lot to talk about. The one thing, I guess, in production is there is an obvious similarity to Snow White. We have a sleeping princess, where I guess Snow White's like Germany. We're back in France, like Cinderella. One of the criticisms was that Disney was kind of treading on ground they'd already done, which I think is still a little bit leveled at this film, because while it is technically the brilliant film, it's sometimes not seen as the best one story-wise, I guess. But there's a lot.
Well, if only those critics knew how the next 50 and 60 years would continue to develop and just reuse that same trope over and over, just in different scenarios, right?
Yeah, because they got to put Aurora in a pink dress, which she doesn't. And they, they fight over the dress color as the animators did, right? So in all of the promotional, she's always wearing the pink dress, so you can tell her apart from Cinderella, Well, the Cinderella's got pink dress. They could switch their colors too if they want.
And also, I think Walt maybe takes too much heat for this, because it's not like Disney or even the Grimm's brothers were the ones that were regurgitating the same story. The story of Sleeping Beauty, I think, might be one of the oldest ones out of all the stories so far that Disney has kind of adapted. Grimm did have their rendition of Sleeping Beauty, but the very first Sleeping Beauty could be as old as the 1200s, I think. Like, it could be back as the 13th century, and it was part of the Book of 1001 Nights, like the same one that, that you're familiar with for a lot of other stories. And it was maybe like two or three paragraphs long. And it was very short, and it was the exact same premise, where a girl meets the prince, but then she gets put under a spell by a witch. And instead of being pricked by a finger on a spinning wheel, it was like a flaxseed. And she ends up getting like a flaxseed stuck under one of her fingernails or something like this. And that knocks her out, and she falls asleep until the prince goes to kisses her, and then notices the flaxseed under her nail, removes it from under her nail, and then she wakes up. And this is like a very, very short story, but it dates all the way back to, some people date it to like the 9th century, but it's no later than the 13th century. So this is essentially the prototypal Sleeping Beauty. And then it gets readapted by the Germans, it gets readapted by the French, by the Italians. And I think the one that Walt essentially based it on was a French version that was based on an Italian version from the 1600s. So again, it's not like Walt, copying himself over, although they decided that this was the thing that they wanted to do. But if also like Snow White was kind of a knockout of the park, Cinderella was sort of a knockout of the park, so why not do another princess story, especially compared to all the other movies they had kind of done that didn't have that same mass appeal, I guess, didn't have that same like knockout effect. So again, like, might makes right, the proof is in the pudding. This was sort of the right decision in this case.
So the original one does have her meeting the prince beforehand.
There are so many really weird variations of this story, man. Like, I don't even know which ones we want to get into because some get really wild. But the very original version is the girl. I don't think she meets the prince first. I think that her dad basically consults with like the wise people of, you know, his castle. And they basically say, hey, your daughter's going to go great. But when she turns of age, she's going to get a flaxseed like behind her. If she touches a flaxseed, because he basically wishes out to the gods, oh, gods, if I can have a daughter, even. And it's such a weird thing. Like, he almost plants like the detriment to him. But he's like, oh, gods, if I could just have the daughter, even if she's like deathly, you know, allergic to flax seeds, that's fine. Just give me a daughter. So, of course, he gets a daughter that's deathly allergic to flax seeds. So all the wise people are telling him like, hey, man, when your daughter becomes 16, or basically the equivalent of puberty, when your daughter hits puberty, she's going to get a flax seed, caught somewhere on her, and she's going to be poisoned by it. And that's, I mean, it's the exact same story. You just kind of shift flaxseed and a needle and wise men into Maleficent, and there it is.
Thinking, because I think Disney considered her meeting the prince first as to be their own addition to the story. Because I was asking which version, because the one I was familiar with is she's sleeping for, like, the kingdom is actually sleeping for 100 years. Which wouldn't make sense if she meets the prince beforehand. And I came to this movie with that in mind, which, yeah, like.
Well, the original adaptation that sprouted after that 13th century version, the one that started coming around in like the 16 or 1700s, this one, it wasn't a prince. It was actually a king that was already married, and he would come across Sleeping Beauty. And he was so attracted to her that he just had his way with her while she was asleep. And there was no kissing and waking up and true love or anything. It was, he just had it. He was like, oh, wow, sleeping girl, super adorable, had his way with her. And then the wife finds out that she gets pregnant. So she starts plotting against how she's going to like take out Sleeping Beauty and take out these kids. So Sleeping Beauty in these older versions does not waken from the kiss. There's two variations. One variation is that she has these children. Somehow she sleeps all the way through her own, she has like twins. She has a boy and a girl, I believe, two twins. And they represent like the sun and the moon, because the original Sleeping Beauty story is kind of based on like these creation myths. And she's sort of Ishtar and Astarte and like the original fertility goddess. And we'll get into some of this stuff. But essentially, she kind of represents this thing, and her giving birth to these two twins, one way that she wakes up is one of the babies is trying to suckle and it gets her finger instead of her nipple, and it sucks the flax seed out from behind her fingernail, and that's what wakes her up. And in another variation, it's kind of like that, is that as the two babies try to, breastfeed on her, that wakes her up and her maternal instincts kind of kick in. And, so in neither of those versions, it's ever the kiss. And in fact, that was one of the, not that Walt did this, I think in one of the later, the version that essentially got adapted by Disney, that guy softened it by taking out, the rapey parts and sort of put in like a softer version of that.
Yeah, I'm sitting here wondering if I've like Mandela affected this whole movie, because before I watched it last week, in my mind, she didn't meet the prince first. 100 years did occur in the story, and the prince was basically like going off to on his own, like, I have to prove myself or something and check out this kingdom. So like, just
in the original stories, yeah, it's 100 years, although in the very OG, there's no, like, she doesn't fall asleep for that long. It doesn't even really indicate. It just mentions that she goes into this like sleep that she has to be saved from. But in the modern stories and the Grimm, I believe it's 100 years. But in the movie, as soon as they start putting everyone to sleep, they're like, oh, wait, wake everyone back up. So it almost feels like it happens within the span of like a week, maybe, at least in the Disney movie.
That's where I'm saying it's either my faulty memory, can't talk either, or I can blame CERN on changing the movie, which is, of course, the option I'd like to choose.
the Berenstain Bear sort of
analogy. Yeah. I had a very firm memory of that story. And it's not like I've been out there like reading versions of Sleeping Beauty. So I'm like, I'm sitting here wondering how I got that into my head. Because you say Joseph Campbell, you say hero's journey. First image that always comes to my mind is the prince fighting dragon Maleficent, you know?
And before we move on from some of that aspect too, is that in the original stories where it's the wife that wants to get revenge and kill her and, you know, kill her kids, there's also a cannibalistic version of this where the way that she wants to kill the kids is by ordering her cook to turn them into a meal. In that version, the cook decides not to and kind of like helps the kids escape. But there, it gets dark. There's some very dark sort of themes that come up in the earlier versions of this one before it made its way. And actually, an example of where Grimm aren't the ones that made something super dark. It actually predates them.
I'm actually seeing here, I guess we'll talk about the music a little bit, Sleep being based on Tchaikovsky. Because last night I was like, oh, I have some CDs back there. Maybe I'll listen to some of the Tchaikovsky version, you know, when I go to bed. It's three CDs long, so that didn't happen. It's a really long ballet, apparently. But that did catch me, because I probably the last time I saw Sleeping Beauty was the first time it was released on DVD. So it's been a while. And there's a guy that plays an orchestra. So I was like, well, oh, what a minute, you know, when the music starts. So it's like, hey, there's ripping off Tchaikovsky. Oh no, they based it on Tchaikovsky. Okay, that's better.
I'm surprised you didn't recognize that already, like from before, but I guess if you've only seen it once when it came out on DVD. But there was an interview with Walt Disney himself around the production of this, or around the release, and he mentions that the original sort of DNA for this entire movie started with Tchaikovsky. Like, it started with him listening to that music and saying, when we make this Sleeping Beauty movie, it needs to be an animated version of Tchaikovsky. So it really did start, at least according to Walt, that was the heart of Sleeping Beauty originally, was Tchaikovsky, and everything else followed that. All the aesthetics and all of the, you know, the unicorn tapestries and everything else, that kind of came secondary to this is an animated version of this Tchaikovsky.
Right. Yeah, I can go with that. I'm just looking at the CDs here to see if that's where I got the 100 years idea from, but or where I got into my head, but it's actually mostly in, no clues to that. So, but definitely makes it one of their classier scores. So you can't really complain about the songs in this one.
Well, and you know, another reason why you can't complain about the songs is originally there were supposed to be five or six more sort of Broadway, you know, like every other Disney movie that had come before this one outside of Snow White. And even Snow White had a couple, but like, you know, I think it had a whole bunch that were originally animated. They even had animatics and storyboards, but at one of the last moments, Walt decided, no, we want this to be a little bit more serious. And I want it to kind of stand as this artistic expression piece, more so than like the predictable show tune-y thing that comes with the soundtrack. And the one song that they ended up keeping was the I'm already blanking on the name of the song, but the Dream a Dream or something, or It Came to Me in a Dream. What's the name of it?
By you saying that, I've now lost it. Hold on, I think I still got my my stuff up here. Once Upon a Dream.
Once Upon a Dream, yeah. So it was originally Once Upon a Dream, and then five and six other kind of like kitschy, singy songy Broadway tunes, and they got cut because they just weren't serious enough.
Yeah, because we see the fairies failed cake, right? The one that's kind of falling off to the side, and that was actually the culmination of like a 5 minute song, dance, and giggle sequence, similar to,
right? And that original sequence was supposed to end with the cake exploding and this whole like this big, you know, cacophony of things happening. And again, it seemed to Walt that this wasn't the tone that he was trying to set for this particular scene. So the cake almost falling over was almost like the crescendo of goofiness for that particular scene, especially compared to what the original animatics had.
Yeah. I wonder if that, like put audiences off a little bit at the time. Maybe they were expecting that because Sleeping Beauty didn't immediately make its production costs back because it cost a lot of money. It was somewhat successful. Yeah. It was not re-released during Walt Disney's lifetime, which I mean, that's only like what, 7 years or whatever. But
and they also never did. They never really devoted that much resource to a production ever again. So it was sort of de facto the end of that particular era of dumping everything you had into the animation. Almost everything that came after this started to lighten up a little bit and take some extra shortcuts. Whereas this one, for whatever reason, they really decided not to take the same shortcuts that they had in other movies.
Well, yeah, it took them 8 years. I guess we'd say 7.5 if we want to be nice. But yeah, I mean, the attention to detail is clear. But apparently now it is, with re-releases and video, it is now the second most successful movie from 1959. So eventually it made a turnaround. So it had to like seep into the public unconscious first, you know, and then yeah, I mean,
it's only second to Ben-Hur. That was the number one movie of the release year. So
right, so it is kind of weird. And it did seem like, yeah, they, other than the fact that they built the castle, you know, before the movie came out, Disney did seem to mildly ignore this one for quite a while. This was, I believe, the first big DVD release, because they were just like, hey, this is great animation, no one's been thinking about it for the past 40 years.
And they also, this movie, they made extremely good use of the wide format because it was 70 millimeter horizontal on the reel. And I think that the original frames that all the animators were working with, they were used to working on typical notepads that you could just kind of like flip through that they had been working with for most of their adult careers. And then this movie comes along and one of the animator interviews referred to it as working on cells the size of a bed sheet and trying to like flip through them. And then that was a little bit of a sort of a hyperbole of the animator at the time, but we weren't talking about the same traditional. And that's why there was so much detail in these two, is that there were these huge, wide, you know, landscape panoramic pieces of paper, and they would just pack them with details. And that was sort of a new thing. I mean, that was breaking a little bit of ground.
Yeah, on television, this becomes like a travesty of a pan and scan, basically. So, which is probably why that another reason that DVD release, which did include a pan and scan too, but why
that? And this was a stereo soundtrack too, which I think was the first Disney, might have been one of the first feature length animations that had like a full stereo orchestra track to go along with it.
Apparently, if you saw the 70 millimeter like Cinerama or whatever presentation, it was actually 6 channels.
Okay, that's probably what it was, and not just stereo, but it was almost, you know, surround sound.
If you saw the normal, you know, 35 millimeter normal version, yeah, it was just stereo. But yeah, if you went to the Super Swank Roadshow version, you would get a 6 channels, which I guess Fantasia tried that a little bit, but on a much more like a hi-fi for the time, but lo-fi for even 1959. So,
and not to miss that this one has the perfect length, in my opinion, of about just, you know, a little bit over 60 minutes run length once you take all the credits out and everything. Because we've talked about this before, some movies, you know, get like 2 hours long, some of them were like 50 minutes or something like that. This one, I think the total run length was like a minute and 10 or an hour and 10 minutes. But outside those credits, it's almost like a very neat, just a full hour. The pacing's great. Everything like this. So many of those different aspects, the removal of all those, the show toony songs, you know, letting one particular guy, at least until the very end when he leaves, have just like ultimate dictator-esque kind of say. But it all culminated in a really great movie.
Yeah. It's like the Disney problem now of taking like your 60-minute Pinocchio, deciding to remake it at like 2.5 hours and then like taking out anything interesting. So, of course, the live action one of this, I guess, would be Maleficent, which I saw shortly after its release. And I remember liking that one. I didn't watch it again for this, but I do remember actually enjoying that one perfectly fine. So
how much of that do you remember? I'm curious, because I haven't seen that one yet.
Well, we got a lot of Jolie. It is one thing that surprised me is it actually is this story, just with the perspective switch, which actually technically should be changed from the good fairies to Maleficent, right?
But see, Maleficent does some very evil things. And again, I haven't, I'm kind of looking forward to watching Maleficent to see how they justify her position. But she shows up uninvited to a party and condemns a girl to death and then disappears. So like, how do you spin that into being like, oh, she was just misunderstood, you know?
She got shafted by the fairies earlier or something. I don't remember. Of course, it's Angelina Jolie.
She takes it out on this poor girl entering adulthood. She's like, oh, you got your period. Now you're going to die. And that's all because of these fairies, you know, pissed me off a while ago.
No, I'm basically just on. Unfortunately, it's been like almost 10 years now. So I'm just like, I remember not hating that one. That and the Jungle Book are the only ones where I was like, I guess these aren't too bad for the live action ones. I almost like want to hate. I've heard so many bad things about the Pinocchio one. I almost feel like maybe I do have to watch it.
Well, I think, of course.
I mean, a train wreck it is.
Have you ever seen the horror movie Pinocchio? I think it was like 98 or 99 or something. It's really bad, but it's something you have to watch.
Yeah, Pinocchio is a weird one where every director feels like they have to do it and they probably shouldn't. So I'm pretty sure you have a few interesting notes on this one, getting into the weirder parts, if we want to kick off part of that.
Yeah, I don't even know where to start. My notes are so scattered, but I'm just going to kind of rapidly go through some, and any that you take affinity to, we'll just go on a little tangents or something. But one thing to point out is that she has multiple names in this. So she's Aurora, she's Sleeping Beauty, she's Briar Rose, and then towards the end of the movie, they all just kind of keep calling her Rose.
Mildly confusing. But that is correct. That's the name she would respond to at that point in time. So
it is correct. Yeah, it is correct. And these are all homages to different variations of, you know, who she was throughout these different stories that it all have been adapted from. And the Briar Rose essentially means prickly rose. And, you know, she's trying to avoid pricking her finger on something. So there's a lot of kind of like wordplay between the different things that happened to her. And again, those old versions, she got a flaxseed under her fingernail, and that evolved into she was going to prick her finger on flax. And then that just turned into like prick her finger on a needle because it's a little bit easier to correlate. But it really ties all the way back to that Briar Rose name and pricking your finger on this like organic flower. And some of the other cool aspects of this is that she's got the three fairy godmothers, and I'm saying fairy godmother, they don't actually say that at all in the movie, but that's kind of like what Disney
became.
You know, they do raise her, and but they're essentially the three fates of you know, of Greek mythology, and so many other different cultures have the same kind of concept. But one of the sort of the cool synchronicities that I noticed here is that when they make these decisions, their names sort of betray what their background is. So for example, it's Flora, Fauna, and Meriwether. And that, as we were talking about before, this is sort of the retelling of the original creation myth, especially with this female coming into age and then immediately giving birth to the moon and the sun, and then having this like evil mother want to eat them, and then they all kind of get resurrected and she comes back to life. It's sort of this resurrection fertility god story. So you've got Flora, Fauna, and Meriwether, which is basically the three things that represent nature. You know, you've got plants, animals, and the weather. And another interesting aspect of this is that in the three fates, there's the spinner, there's the allotter, and then there's essentially death. And there's a number of scenes in the movie that, again, like attribute these different sort of principles to the three different fairy godmothers. So one of those examples is that Meriwether, who's in charge of the weather, she kind of represents the death aspect. And if you notice, she's always pushing for magic. She's the one that like wants to go and get the magic wands. She's like sort of the one that knows that magic is really what's going to help them all out the most, and she can't not use it. And that kind of represents that magic kind of process of like death and resurrection. And so that's a really interesting aspect, because outside of the fertility goddess, which is like Ishtar and Astarte and Easter, The male counterpart to that is almost always a weather god. It's going to be Zeus with his lightning bolt. It's going to be Jupiter. It's going to be Hadad. Like, these were all rain gods and storm gods. So there's just so many correlations there.
The first draft of this, interestingly, had 8 fairies. This includes Maleficent as a fairy. Right. So they went from 8, which that's an interesting number, of course, down to 4. And their specific ideas apparently were the fairy of dreams, the fairy of the forest, the fairy of the elements, and the fairy of darkness, which, I mean, that doesn't like counteract what you're saying, just trying to add some detail and definition there.
Well, and not just that, that's Walt Disney's version, but in not the original version, because again, that original version was very straightforward, and it was just the king kind of consulted with his wise man, and in some it's like wise women, and they just kind of give him this rough idea, oh, something's going to happen to her. There's not all these fairies and witches and things, but in the later versions, I think from like the mid 1600s, it starts to shift a little bit, and at this point there's 12 different fairies and I think Maleficent is going to be the 13th fairy, but being the number 13 would have been unlucky, so they decide not to include her because they don't want to invite this concept of bad luck onto their newborn daughter, and then she gets wind of it, and the 12 fairies in those older medieval versions, that was a reference to the zodiac. It was essentially, again, this is the creation story being retold. It's death and resurrection, and it's the weather, Meriwether, flora, fauna. So again, with Meriwether, you've got the 12 months that rotate around. It's the sun, you know, dying and coming back to life. So this entire theme just keeps popping up, and it remains consistent throughout.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly! Auto Parts!
There's that 13th zodiac sign as well, isn't there? Slightly under, I think.
Well, I think in that version that I'm talking about that had the zodiac, they all show up to the baby's christening or whatever, you know, when they're giving them Sleeping Beauty and Aurora, like all these presents, and they all have these like golden plates, and those golden plates are representing their different signs. And in addition to the golden plates, they kind of bestow upon her these different sort of like magical powers.
I like how we add that, though, because the original just seems like a plea for antihistamine or something, you know, a cautionary allergy tale where, you know, we throw in some magic, some fairies, and some darkness. So it gets a little more interesting, I guess.
And even in these medieval versions, we're still only talking like 4 paragraphs, the entire story. You know, we're not talking about a book at any point.
I mean, let's be honest, if you were writing this one out, that you could whittle this down to a 4 paragraph thing, because it's a very visual movie, right? I mean, what Aurora's character gets, what, like 18 lines in the movie, or she's on screen for 18 minutes, something like that. And I mean, she's not in the movie that much.
Yeah. In fact, the focus is really on the fairy godmothers for the most part, which they have the most developed characters, I think, in the movie. And it's also interesting that this movie, they're not really sidekicks. There really are more main characters than they are supporting characters. But in addition to that, this is one of the first times in the Disney movies that we don't have sidekicks and we don't have B plots. It's just the one plot of Sleeping Beauty. Like, there's not these little like side missions going on.
Just kind of like a minute, because the prince, unlike the last 2 movies with princes, this one does get a name. And I felt like they were playing his horse as a bit of a sidekick, you know, just for about a minute.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'll give you that.
Yeah, just that second of levity, I suppose. But
and speaking of that horse really quick, it stood out to me because like the owl makes another appearance here, which was in Fox and the Hound. Like it starts developing this character that you're going to see over and over in Disney movies. So it shows up, I think, in Fox and the Hound, fleshed out pretty well. It shows up again here in this movie looking almost identical. And I think the next time it shows up, yeah, Archimedes is going to come up. And it's like the exact same owl. I'm sure there's nuanced differences, but I saw that same thing happening with the horse here, and I don't remember exactly what movie. I know El Dorado, I think, had horses that look very similar to this style of horse.
I was thinking of Tangled, definitely. I mean, watching this movie now, it didn't really occur to me how much like kind of sync there is with Tangled, you know?
Rapunzel, I kind of love that though. I love seeing like the birth of this very specific character, whether it's the owl or the horse, whatever, and then how they just keep getting developed on over and over until they become like almost their own archetype.
Chip shows up if you're paying attention.
Who does?
Chip. There's a chip-looking chipmunk. Yeah. So I mean that's kind of a cool way to brand it, though. I mean, especially when everything's analog. I don't think that's being lazy. So.
So what else? There's a couple other notes here. One is that if we noticed in Cinderella, the evil stepmother, she had her hair kind of up in like little horns, but they didn't go all the way in and make her look like ultra evil the same way that they kind of do with Maleficent. But all three of Maleficent, the evil mother in Cinderella, and Chernobog, it's essentially the same character. Chernobog gets established first, you know, the black god. Which ironically is also one of the animators that worked on that particular sequence, worked on a lot of the scenes in this movie. But we've got Maleficent as the personification of like the Disney villain that wasn't Chernobog directly, but represented Chernobog in like a very nice sort of animated way. And that's going to continue on. Like you're going to see Maleficent sort of takes the place of Chernobog in the Disney sort of pantheon as being the ultimate Satan, I guess. Like if you had to say kind of how we have, you know, we've got Moloch and we've got Baal and we've got Satan and Lucifer and Leviathan. And but depending on how generalized you look at everything, a lot of people are just like, that's the devil or that's Satan. Right. So in my mind, Maleficent is sort of like the Satan, the devil, the Lucifer of the, you know, the Disney pantheon.
Well, yeah, again, that's why the Tokyo Disney attraction was making children soil their pants, because it was like they in their mind, especially, they're literally being sent to hell, you know.
that would be a pretty awesome like a Chernobog Fantasia ride where it's just like the All Hallows Night or the Witch's Sabbath, and you actually just go through it and fire comes out.
Yeah, I don't remember a specific name, but yeah, find a YouTube video on that one, because it is, you can tell from the video, it's pretty like definitely would terrify most people. excuse me. And yeah, I know my family, like we had, whenever Fantasia came out on VHS is when we got Fantasia. So again, I was probably transposing Chernobog onto the end of this movie in my mind for years. So I might have been slightly disappointed when I got that DVD, because I was like expecting that, which the dragon's fine, don't get me wrong, but Chernobog still does seem to, like you said, they replaced him with Maleficent more or less, but I still think that's the ultimate.
Chernobog is an actual pagan, you know, demon god that people worship. Like that is the real name and sort of a great illustration version of him, but I think it was a little bit too on the nose for where Disney saw everything headed, where, you know, I don't know how profitable and how like cuddly and marketable you can make the literal Chernobog versus Maleficent, you know, that's kind of has like a more pleasing aesthetic to her.
It's gotta be plush Ursulas out there. I'd see that before a plush Maleficent. All the legs would be a little creepy. I don't know if I'd want to plush with that many legs, but hey, some kids like weird stuff. So,
and there's a few visual similarities I caught in this movie from movies that came way after. And I don't know if any of these were intentional, but I just wanted to throw some out because that I didn't see them in other reviews and kind of like takes on this movie. One of them is that Maleficent's castle as soon as I saw on screen, I was like, that's Castle Duckula from Count Duckula. And I had to pause it and I had to Google it. And sure enough, I mean, there's a little bit of variation, but you can almost lay Castle Duckula on top of Maleficent's castle. And it's the same thing. So I thought that was really, really cool. And what else? Oh, the her little like soiree of creatures that have little helmets and spikes and some have horns and stuff. The ones that are looking for Sleeping Beauty, but they're idiots because they're looking for a baby for 16 years and they never find her because, you know, she's like grown up or whatever. They look almost identical to the Jim Henson little creatures in Labyrinth, you know, the guys that work under the Labyrinth Master. And I had to pull again a screen up, and that one's not as one for one because it's, you know, puppets versus cartoons. But man, the archetypes of the characters and just the silhouettes of some almost, you know, matched up perfectly.
This, I mean, this is me mostly saying something silly, but actually it might have some of that subconscious impact. Like I said, right before we did this podcast, I had also done Avatar. So last night I was watching Sleeping Beauty and Avatar, and while drifting off to sleep, I had like images of Aurora being, you know, chased by like the horse monster things from Pandora, which works fine. It's, you know, it's kind of the same thing in a way, like the minions in this movie and something like, you
and,
know,
and those, the minions in this movie too. They struck me as they visually look like some of the descriptions that Paracelsus made of what he called Paracelsian monsters. And if you're not familiar with Paracelsus, he's sort of the great godfather of medicine. He's the first one that realized the principle of toxicity and of dilution, that something in a high dose can kill you, but in a smaller dose can help you. He was kind of like one of the first people that was able to articulate that properly throughout the world. But he had a lot of weird, wacky ideas. And one of his weird, wacky ideas was that you could create a homunculus. And if you allowed a homunculus to develop through maturity, and a homunculus is basically like a little version of yourself. It's like a mini me that you can create in like a flask or something. But if you create a mini me and you let it grow into adulthood, it'll turn into what he called these Paracelsian monsters, or he called them monsters. We call them Paracelsian monsters based on his name. And some of the descriptions of those monsters are kind of what these little creatures look like. So, I mean, it was almost impossible for me to not tie the, like a, almost an alchemical principle in here. Cause again, the original story is talking about giving birth to twins that are the sun and the moon, and having to sacrifice them only to be reborn, and the 12 golden plates, and these Paracelsian monsters. Like, there is a deep alchemical, probably Rosicrucian theme that's kind of persisting throughout this this movie.
And how do you make a homunculus? No, don't answer it now. It took me a while to get through that podcast. You could go hear that somewhere else if you want. Very interesting, but took me a few stops and listen to our podcast for a bit, then come back to it.
To be fair, that is a very particular way to make a homunculus. That's not what, there's no universal agreement on that particular one, but I would say that 90% of homunculus recipes get X-rated towards the end of them. So
yeah, right on. That's the only way to do it.
I mean, just like making a normal person, it gets X-rated at a certain point, does it not?
Well, yeah, earlier in that case. what's next on your note then?
Let me see. So there's a couple cool just dynamics of magic, which is sort of obvious because they're actually using magic wands and casting spells, but it's just kind of cool in the movie at least. Maleficent comes in and she puts this curse on Sleeping Beauty, on Aurora. And after she leaves, one of the other fairies is able to sort of cast like an anti-magic spell. So she kind of converts that, instead of you pricking your finger and dying, it's you're gonna prick your finger and go to sleep. And it's the order that actually makes sense here, because in the original version of these 12 zodiacs showing up and then the 13th one being unlucky, Disney reinterprets that one as like the seven, and Maleficent comes up. But Maleficent cuts one of the other fairies off in line, essentially, when she does her little spell. And it's sort of implying that if she had waited her turn and done it at the end, no one would have been able to reverse it. No one would have been able to do like a counter magic spell. So part of her being like too eager to cast her magic sort of bit her in the ass in the end. That was
wait in line, folks.
On it. Yeah, wait in line.
my note for that was, I bet she was about to give the gift of bath bombs before Maleficent showed up. I don't know if
what else?
Oh, sorry. I just had a thought jump out of my mind. Oh, here we go. When we were doing Snow White, we definitely had the idea that she was actually casting spells and she could talk to the animals. So Aurora doesn't seem to quite be that deep in magic herself, but she definitely has that same like nature connection. Maybe just because she lives in the woods. I don't know.
Yeah, no, so Aurora in this movie is very much passive. Magic happens to her and it happens around her, and it maybe happens because of just being in proximity to her. But she very much in this particular movie, she herself is not casting the magic, but she stands for magic because, again, she is Ishtar and Aesthetr. And a lot of the older versions of this tale, they actually link her directly to these old fertility goddesses. And it's that concept of, you know, winter comes and nature seemingly comes to a dead halt, and you wonder, man, is the snow ever going to go away, and are my crops ever going to come back, or are we just all going to starve to death? And then eventually the winter ends and the summer comes again. So she is just a retelling of the nature story, but she herself is not causing any of this magic. Again, it's happening to her kind of as nature. And then there's a sort of an interesting nod to this where there's so many different ones that repurpose the story, but in the 1650s version, the medieval version, there's a nod to this because they mention that the prince notices, or the fairies tell the prince, don't tell Sleeping Beauty that she's wearing her great grandmother's dress. And this is a sort of a nod that when she went to sleep, it was the old pagan gods that ruled the earth. And then 100 years pass, and now that she's waking up, again, that 100-year version that you're mentioning, 100 years pass, now when she wakes up, the world has evolved around her, and the world is now kind of like following Christ. You know, they're following these new monotheistic religions, and they've got rid of the old pagan religions. So her falling asleep and waking back up is also representative of shedding that old fertility goddess pagan approach to things, and like the more refined, you know, more civilized Christian approach to it.
I guess it's the whole Rip Van Winkle thing that appeals to me, that if I do have something lacking from this movie, it's like I do like that element a lot. So I wish it was here, and it didn't seem like she just took a 5-minute nap, but you know.
I feel like if they did that, the exposition required, now, I mean, you just went from 8 years to 10 years because of that extra 5 minutes, right?
Oh, yeah. You'd have to be making a different movie from the get-go for sure. But the Mandela effect thing that I keep calling out, just in my mind, that is how this movie rolls. So, yeah, it is weird. Again, I haven't been in the States for 12 years. So whenever I do go back, I'll have my own experience along those lines for sure.
So Aurora does do one thing. I wouldn't call it a magic incantation, but she says something, and I made a note because it was like, that doesn't really sound accurate at all. And I tried to do some research, and I think it was just written in this particular Disney script, but she says, they say if you dream a thing more than once, it's sure to come true. And it was just, it sounded so silly that I had to write it down, because no part of that, or how I can read it, does it ring true in any context that if you just dream about a thing more than once, it's sure to come true. I mean, maybe law of attraction, maybe the law of positive thinking. But she's actually talking about, she fell asleep and had a dream about a prince on more than one occasion, and because of that, it was guaranteed to happen to her, which is very wishful thinking. So maybe this could be her putting her intentions out into the universe, right? So maybe that's part of her magic, but it feels like things are happening to her.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't want to have last night's dream twice. Again, this is maybe because I watched Sleeping Beauty and Avatar in conjunction with each other. So it's just to throw out it has imagery from both, so it's fun, but I was going to see this Buddha on the other side of a pagoda, like a tall pagoda. But to get there, you had to like climb along the roof. You know, very precarious. Although I looked down at one point, and weird for a dream, I was like, well, if I fell, it's really going to hurt. But I guess I wouldn't die. And they get, there's a platform, there's a big like Buddha image. And then they roll out a carpet, like medieval looking carpet. And okay, you just walk down the stairs to get out of here. I was like, okay, that's weird. But that was like a special service. Usually you have to go out the way you came, like, and then scale the ceiling again. So I don't know. I have weird dreams. I don't know. Maybe
you have to sign a waiver before you go into that one.
No, not in the dream world. Probably not in Japan, to be perfectly honest. We took my daughter a couple times to the ninja park up in the mountains. And yeah, you got kids like climbing around on these precipices on trees. I mean, you could kill yourself in 8 different ways there without a problem. And they just let anyone roll in and do it.
You just add the word extreme to the front of it and do an upsell, right?
Yeah, I say ninja. Ninja gets the, everyone understands yeah, that. So. Yeah, you don't have to add extreme when you've already said ninja.
That's the American version, the extreme ninja park.
No, when we first took my daughter there, I posted it for my family and friends on Facebook, and I was like, the world's most dangerous amusement park. And it doesn't have rides.
I think there was a place in New Jersey that takes the cake on that.
Oh, Action Park?
That Action Park, yeah.
Okay. I know what that is. Yeah. Well, the thing is, people are careful at Ninjamura, right? So I guess, yeah. Like, I mean, you don't want to put 2 little kids up on there, but I think a lot of kids understand if I do this, I'm going to hurt myself. Yeah, the whole thing of doing it Chanto in Japan, doing it the right way, which sometimes can be very annoying, but in cases like theme parks, it's fantastic because, yeah, I mean, Disneyland, Tokyo Disneyland Sea, I mean, people walk away, they're well dressed, there's no garbage, they don't have paint chipping there like ever. It's crazy. All the animatronics are working. If they don't, if you find something that isn't, it will be the next day. You know, talk to the Yeti. There was Animal Kingdom.
There was a video I had seen recently that made me think of that as you were mentioning it, and it was, you might know the context better than I do, because I'm just going to throw out like the random parts that I remember. But I believe it was a bunch of people in Japan and they were protesting something. It wasn't like a particularly antagonistic protest, but they were protesting in the middle of the street. And then as soon as the lights began to turn red, they'd all like calmly get out of the street and let the traffic pass, and then as soon as the lights turned red again, they'd get back in the street and continue their protest. And it was just like a very ordered clockwork version, and like they were being very careful and not inconvenience traffic and not, you know, commit any sort of like break any laws in the process. And it was just surreal because I've never seen anything like that.
They weren't protesting traffic protocol.
Right.
I found sometimes
it's such a foreign concept though.
I've been around long enough, actually. I guess I do give a hand these days, but you know, at the end of a party, it's time to clean up, and you know, we'll slack around in the States, and you know, dishes are still there tomorrow. Where in Japan, sometimes blink, you're like, "Whoa, everything's clean. What happened?" when we were living in America for a few years, my friend was house sitting a guy's house. He had a bunch of like cool like monster movie punk rock memorabilia, but. Yeah, my wife was there, and then she felt compelled to just clean the place for 2 hours. Like, no, you really don't have to do that. So I had a friend living in a punk rock house. I was like, no, you cannot come with me to see him, because she would try to clean that and it wasn't going to happen.
That happens in the States too, but it's usually meth involved.
Yeah. So, but yeah. Just what you're talking about with the demonstration doesn't sound surprising to me. 11 years ago with the earthquake and tsunami and Fukushima and all that, like there wasn't any looting or anything. So it was pretty wild. You know, people actually chill out. I mean, there are flaws in Japan for sure, but I would say that's not one of them. how far down your note list are you?
I got 3 other notes and they're all just kind of like fun ones. So
okay,
I was getting really strong Castle Grayskull vibes when we started getting like close up shots of Maleficent's castle. And I took some screenshots again because it looks so close. And I kind of did a left and right comparison, especially because they start using like a green and purple lighting aspects on it. Like the lighting sources are like these fluorescent purple and green lights. and it just reminded me of some old He-Man scenes. And it sure
I did make a Castle Grayskull note. I'm glad having trouble spotting it at the moment for some reason. But no, I definitely was like, expect you could just get He-Man to save you from this problem, you know?
Also, what else? There was sorry, what were you gonna say?
Oh, and when I was 5 or 6 years old, my father bribed me to jump off the diving board by like, okay, if you dive, I'll get you Castle Grayskull. And that's how I got Castle Grayskull.
and a broken arm.
Yeah. You could only need one arm to play with Grayskull, right?
What else? Oh, so one of the ones that stood out the most to me, and I loved this aspect of it, but that final scene where the prince kills Maleficent dragon version, there's blood, man. Like, we actually see, you know, an unharmed animal that gets pierced by a weapon and blood comes out of it, and then they die, and it doesn't cut away and it doesn't happen off screen. Like, you see all of it essentially happen. The only time that it leaves screen is when she converts back from her dragon form into kind of just like a pile of ash or clothes. But I mean, you see the violence there, and you know, I can't think of a lot of other Disney movies where they kill the villain and you see blood come out in the process.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm trying to think if there's anything there. Oh, Black Cauldron. I don't know if that has it or not, because it's been so long, but that would certainly be a place for it.
I mean, there's some movies where people get hurt and they draw blood, but I can't think of death scenes that involve blood in them, just because it's so foreign to a typical Disney formula. I'm sure they're out there. So maybe we need to dig that up.
I figured out why I couldn't find my Grayskull note. It looks like I forgot to save a large portion of my notes, because my last note is gotta fuel up your minstrel with alcohol. So I'm like, oh, that's not near the end of the movie. So oops, I must have I was late night viewing last night.
Oh, and my final note too, a little bit of Rosicrucian and alchemical references, but Maleficent cast a spell towards the end of the movie too, when she casts it over the castle that blocks the prince's way to get in, and he has to kind of like hack his way through. That spell that she does is so Shakespearean. It sounds very much like the boil and boil, toil and trouble, you know, eye of a newt, wing of a bat kind of thing, which is interesting, because that same cadence and that same sort of word patterning, that essentially is hearkening back to not exactly alchemy, but like the first sort of like witch doctors. And it's because they would call their things, you know, the eye of a newt, I think, was like a mustard seed. And it was just because that was how you used to protect the kernels, you know, secret recipe back then, is that you just didn't tell people, oh yeah, it's, you know, it's barbecue rub with mustard seeds. You'd be like, oh yeah, it's bat wings and newt eyes. So you'd have to know what those code words were in order to like replicate it. So that same kind of aspect of obfuscation kind of makes its way into the way that Maleficent is casting these spells. I just thought it was an interesting thread.
Did you happen to write down her thorn spell?
Not the exact spell, no.
Because you said Shakespearean, I'm wondering if the cadence you're mentioning is like the whole iambic pentameter thing, which would give it that. All I'm finding is a forest of thorns shall be used to. I'm finding a YouTube, and maybe they print it as well, because I'm wondering if that cadence. Well,
I'm not talking about the original spell. It's after, it's towards the end of the movie, as the prince makes his way out of captivity and he's heading towards Sleeping Beauty. She casts a spell over Sleeping Beauty's castle that she's in.
Oh, sorry, if that's making noise.
The same cadence.
It started to play the actual movie. Yeah, this is what I'm looking at, and I'm wondering if you were here. Okay, here we go. A forest of thorns shall be his tomb, born through the skies in a fog of doom. Now go with a curse and serve me well round Stefan's castle, cast myself. So I think it is in that iambic pentameter, which might, you know, spell saying things. That's how it works, right? So it seems not just Shakespearean, but the actual cadence. Do you know the other very famous writer who also almost always wrote in iambic pentameter?
I wasn't prepared for this trivia. No. Who is that?
Dr. Seuss. Dr. Seuss and Shakespeare used the same pattern.
So he's casting spells.
Yeah, in a way. That's chewy chew for chewy chewing. That's what this goo goose is doing. if you choose, sir, do, sir, it's the same rhythm that he uses. So, yeah, I have to do Fox and Socks a lot because I teach English.
I think there's a thread. There's actually a thread here, man. There's a thread worth pulling on.
No, but I mean, that's an important thing, the cadence of spells. That's why the words, why you use certain words, why it might sound weird because it must follow this pattern. So, yeah, that's my point. I think that is on to something a little bit baked in, but maybe that, you know, magical language requires you to use certain cadences, right? So maybe if you use a different kind of spell, you use a different cadence.
Well, we're going to have to try and conjure something up on one of these live.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. yeah, and then we get then other things. What, Dune has like the voice, so that sort of thing. But the power of vibration, right? Everything's vibration. So I think that actually is a obviously we were researching Sleeping Beauty and not that. So I'm walking us into a dead end at the moment. But it's a, you know, maybe there's a door at the dead end at some point.
I like that because I'm going to keep an ear open for more of those iambic pentameter sort of examples, especially when it comes to people doing the spells and reciting them.
And I think it basically comes down to big, small, 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 and everything's rhyming couplets. So they always have to rhyme and you don't rhyme the next part. So you don't change the rhyming scheme, which is also, I think, an important thing of it.
And I wonder, too, is Shakespeare the one that linked that cadence to it being magical through that famous line, or did that pre-exist? And when I say Shakespeare, I obviously mean Francis Bacon, because Shakespeare was not a real person.
I was about to bring up Francis Bacon anyway. I was about to say I don't mind if Shakespeare can be real person, but I definitely like the idea that the magic man was actually writing all this stuff.
or like a group of people that were kind of, he was almost like it's like a Jack the Ripper, you know, he wasn't killing people, but it was like a group of these nobles that were doing shocking things and putting it out under someone else's name.
I'm always a fan of the Crowley was Jack the Ripper theory, but that's just because, you know, let's throw. Some,
he would have been on the tail end, though. He'd be on the tail end of the Jack the Rippers because it would have started before he was born. No,
you might be right. It's been a while. I didn't watch From Hell, so
you got to read the comic, anyways. It's a million times better than the movie.
Actually, I think I did read the comic, but a really long time ago. Yeah.
it's not a quick or easy read, but it's a very good read.
Yeah, it would have been about the same time I read Mouse. Same thing. Not a quick or easy read.
Yeah, it's not like if someone's like, hey, I'm going to go read a comic book this weekend, you're not thinking Mouse.
If that's the end of your list, I guess we'll start wrapping things up for today. But did you have any final things you wanted to throw out for Sleeping Beauty?
Not really. I had this book that I just haven't been able to get all the way through yet, but it's been, oh, of course it's not going to show up, but it's called The Initiatory Paths in Fairy Tales, Alchemical Secrets of Mother Goose. And it doesn't necessarily do a fairy tale by fairy tale, but it explains these common archetypes that are going over. And great examples are Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, Snow White, because they follow the same kind of path and they hearken on something that I've mentioned in a few of our previous ones that also shows up in this one a little bit. And that's the rabbit symbolism and the underworld and the recycling, because in Alice in Wonderland, it's, you know, follow the white rabbit, and that represents Persephone and it represents Easter. And in this movie, there is a scene where the owl comes down and it pulls these two rabbits out of a log. So it stood out to me as that rabbit being linked to Ishtar and Easter. And they were kind of like two twin rabbits. So I always wonder if that was a nod to the original DNA of the Sleeping Beauty story, where she has the two twins and those twins represent this nature cycle. Because again, in the old secret mystery cults, the rabbits represented that, and they represented, you know, Ishtar and Easter. And that's where you get the Easter bunny. It was because of this link between the fertility gods and goddess and the rabbits.
Just with owls, my workplace, I just got threw out, has a bunch of owls in it. The main school, tons of owls. The old boss really liked owls, or maybe she was part of a secret society. No, I think she just really liked owls. But then we just opened a new one, and even then, not so many owls, but there's still one big owl painting on the wall. So whenever I see that, of course, it's a guy that likes to think about this sort of thing. I'm like, there's an owl again.
They get a bad rap. A lot of people see an owl, especially conspiratorially minded, and it's like, oh, Bohemian Grove, Illuminati, get, you know, guaranteed. But man, I really do, especially these Disney movies. I try my best to find the owl symbolism. What in Snow White, there's a scene when they're inside of the little shack that she's staying in with the seven dwarves, and there's just the faintest outline of owls carved into the staircase. And there's just countless conspiracy blogs out there that's like, Illuminati confirmed. There's owls in the staircase. And I mean, I watched that scene over and over, and I counted them, and I looked for other symbols around them. And really, as much as I want to look into it, it just seemed like a cool design with owls in it. And yeah, it so far, foresty. Yeah, it seems foresty. It's a cool animal. They represent cool things. It's got a cool aesthetic to it. So even in this movie with the owl, I mean, I'm hurting myself trying to bend in ways to be like, oh, that's a Bohemian Grove reference. It just doesn't happen yet. It will in some of the movies coming up, but at this point, it doesn't happen. Although you mentioned earlier MK Ultra, and I want to note that this movie in particular, Sleeping Beauty, is kind of at peak MK Ultra time, you know, like early 50s through late 50s. So a lot of the conspiracy references were, you know, Disney and MK Ultra were hand in hand around this time. It's harder to disprove those outright, you know, that like MK Ultra didn't exist yet. So at this point they do, and there's a bluebird in this movie, and there's all sorts of other sort of mind control references. So
well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. And it doesn't have to be like there's a, you know, someone, you know, snidely snively in the hanging out in animation putting this thing on purpose. It's kind of like, hey, we got a note. Could you do this? Yeah, sure. Why not?
Yeah.
Put a bluebird in, please. Okay, I can do that. One of the most interesting scenes I think ever in any movie is the scene in Mulholland Drive where they switch out the idol singer. Have you seen Mulholland Drive?
In the 90s, I saw okay. it, and I remember being so confused by the ending.
Anyway, there's a scene where it has like the starlet, you know, like trying, someone basically normal trying to sing, and then someone comes in and says, she's not the one, get rid of her. And then they bring in like this blonde, like, you know, like the presidential model sort of lady. And she just instantly starts bopping. And, you know, I saw in the 90s, I was like, oh, that's weird. What does that even mean? And now I'm like, oh yeah. Okay. I think I got that. So that's actually definitely one David Lynch movies. I think David, yeah, it might just be subconscious stuff too, but I think there's something to look into in a lot of David Lynch's movies for symbology, things like that. But that scene in particular is like, that's how Hollywood works, isn't it?
I'd love to go back through David Lynch's catalog again. I think I watched Twin Peaks a few years ago from beginning to end. It's interesting, although it doesn't hold up the same way that I was hoping it would. And that's probably might be sacrilegious to even say out loud. So I apologize.
No. People keep saying to me, people keep saying to me, you got to watch the new Twin Peaks. I was like, it's really good. You'd love it. I'm like, but I'd have to watch the old one again first. And then I'd have to watch a new one. I don't have time for that. I'll go watch you know Lost what, Highway.
The old one, I love so much the things that they started to hint at, like the little secret society that they had, like the,
oh yeah,
it was called
the Black Lodge.
Man. Yeah. Every time I would watch an episode, I was like, tell me more. I want to learn more about this. And they just never delivered on it. And it still pains me to this day. Like, I still have a little bit of contempt for not delivering on all these like really cool promises that were made.
No. And when I want to go for Twin Peaks, I'll go directly for Firewalk With Me, which doesn't even match the tone of the show. Has the famous scene of David Bowie walking into an office and just screaming. That's like, ah, not saying anything, just screaming. It's great. So very disturbing movie. Because the show is not like disturbing in that way, but the movie is, yeah. Leaves a weird taste in your mouth. Not a nice wholesome one, like a movie like Sleeping Beauty. Just sorry, trying to make the segues work there.
We're definitely not talking about the original versions where the king comes in and just does what he needs to.
Yeah, we just mentioned those a little bit. Yeah, that's creepy. I mean, even in my notes, I didn't know that, because I was writing things like Oh, he's been waiting 16 years to roofie his royal friend. That's the king and the two kings. But then, oh, that didn't happen. Oh, yeah, yeah. I wrote a few notes along those lines, not knowing about those versions of the story. So now I'm like, oh, my notes don't sound good anymore. This is Saturday, I guess, or Sunday. I think I'm doing these on Sunday now. But hey, what's going on your weekend? That's what you can plug right here, right now.
Actually, that's a great question, because this week I just published a new coloring book called The Modern American Lovecraft Adult Coloring Book on Amazon. And I believe that's also available in Japan. And it's 30 pages of just really cool Lovecraftian inspired coloring book pages.
You might have just told me a Christmas present I'm buying for someone.
I mean, please, man, I've got four out now total. So I've got the Lovecraft coloring book. I've got American Cryptids coloring book. I've got one called The Cult of the All-Seeing Eye, which is just got a bunch of cool sort of like pyramids and aliens and reptilian designs. And then I've got one called Paranoid Portraits. And if you're at all a fan of occult and conspiracy theory stuff, I think it's like 25 different portraits of people like Aleister Crowley. We've got Baphomet in there. We've got Manly Palmer Hall. We've got Aldous Huxley. Just cool stuff to, you know, stocking stuffers that no one's going to expect and they won't see coming.
The stocking stuffer you won't see coming.
And you can find all those on paranoidamerican.com as well as on Amazon.
All right. As for this podcast, we do Podcastio. Podcastius is on Patreon, which is, even if you don't want to throw a dollar in to keep the lights on, it's a good hub for all the stuff we do out here in Japan, which Matt and Luke Sci-Fi Sanctuary with sci-fi movies. Time Enough podcast where we talk about the Twilight Zone. And for the gamers, there's Luke Loves Pokemon, Monster Mash, which is about Monster Hunter, and the Game Show, which is four British guys screaming insults at each other. So there's all of, I don't know if I remember, I don't know if I always mention all those at the end of these shows or not, but I did today. Okay.
Good on you.
I'm going to go sleep for 100 years, I guess. That's not true. I'm going to take a shower and go to work, but
make sure you lock your doors.
In Japan, I don't have to do that.
At your job, do you ever have to deal with a nose roller? How about a snub pulley? Well, if you're installing a new conveyor belt system, dealing with the different components can sound like you're speaking a foreign language. Luckily, you've got a team ready to help. Grainger's technical product specialists are fluent in maintenance, repair, and operations. So whenever you want to talk shop, just reach out. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.